Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, my friends. It is time once again for America's Most Haunted Radio, and we are extremely excited about the show tonight. We've been watching this show. It's only two episodes so far, Deals from the Dark Side, and we had no idea what a amazing freak of nature, super cool guy, Steve Santini, really and truly is. Right, Teresa?
That's right. I think they've been hiding him up in Canada, and the United States just getting a little taste of him now because, you know, we're close to Canada, Steve. We're like right there. We're in Cleveland. Not
far. How are you doing?
We can smell Canada. We are doing super extra special well. So I'm reading through your site, which is great,
right,
by the way, Santini Central. And, I mean, you know, we talk to talented people, people who are really great at one thing or another all the time. But you're really great at all kinds of things. It's somewhat intimidating.
Well, I've had a very, very strange and adventurous life. So it's the old story of be careful what you wish for.
I guess. Well, just to let everyone know, in case anyone has been living in a cave or didn't see the first two episodes, we think everyone who listens watches Sci-Fi Channel. It's my fave, followed closely by, of course, the Travel Channel. But let's let people know a little bit what's going on. Sci-Fi has a great new show that combines American Pickers, Oddities, and the movie The Prestige. I kind of patted myself on the back for thinking of that. Deals from the Dark Side, which follows Mohawk collector and historian Steve Santini on his quest to locate, authenticate, and buy history's darkest artifacts, be it a deck chair from the Titanic, Jack the Ripper's knife, a hangman's noose, Houdini's handcuffs, or a Victorian cat o' nine tails. If there's a notorious, mysterious, or tragic tale associated with it, Steve wants it for his one-of-a-kind collection, from which over 60 objects are on long-term loan to the National Museum of Crime and Punishment in Washington, D.C. In addition to collecting, buying, and selling dark relics, Santini is also a master locksmith and performer, whom Ripley's, believe it or not, dubbed the world's most extreme escape artist. And I'm going to cut it there, even though these words are magic, but I'd rather talk directly to you. There's all kinds of other stuff, too. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here.
All right. So now we're back in the real world and talking to you. Yeah, so like I was saying, going through your site, what a fascinating collection of interests, fascinations, and skills you have. And, you know, I'm picking up kind of there's an underlying theme. I think kind of there is something that connects them all. You're a great escape artist. You're a historian, master historian, especially of restraining devices of various types and torture devices. And we also noticed they haven't really talked a lot about it, or maybe not even at all yet on the show, but you also have some sort of, shall we say, paranormal or psychic connection to this material. And ultimately, we get the sense that that is perhaps where your interest lies, in the fact that you pick up on various things, emotions. I don't want to put words in your mouth, of course, but pick up on something from these tainted, these objects that bear extreme emotion or extreme psychic energy. It is an amazing life. Why don't you tell us a little bit? Why don't we start just talking about the show, because that's kind of the immediate thing. But I'm really super interested in hearing how all of this came to be, and this person who is this astonishing collection, came to be talking on the phone to us.
Well, Deals from the Dark Side is a really neat show, because in the show, I travel all across North America with my buddy, Biker Rob, and have my friend and researcher, Steph Proctor, and we're sourcing out these things. I mean, I've been collecting and wheeling and dealing and buying, selling, trading with leading auction houses, international collectors for most of my life. So I'm constantly getting emails and phone calls about things that people have, and they know that appeal to my particular, or should I say peculiar, tastes. And the show follows us as we go out, We meet the people that have these objects. They explain the backstory of these objects. And then, you know, if it's something I really want for my collection, we have to do some research. I mean, because anybody could say they have anything. And that's one thing, you know, I wish we had more time on the show because, you know, the show gives you a smattering of the research that we put into things. But when you're buying something like a Titanic deck chair and you're going to spend tens of thousands of dollars, I mean, there's hours and weeks of research that go into authenticating it. And then some of the objects we found, we find that it just doesn't bear out. The story doesn't hold up, in which case I back away from them, or we take them to other experts that might have a differing opinion than I do. So it's really a journey of discovery. And the coolest thing that holds the whole thread together is that these objects are the kinds of things most people would never have in their homes. I mean, they're all connected usually to tragedy, suffering, pain. Now, that sounds like a pretty maudlin sort of a show, but it's not. It's very exciting because by researching these things, we can find out, you know, where they fit into the pattern of recorded history and how we treated each other down through the centuries.
Yeah, I love that part. You had a line, I forget if it was in the first or second episode, and by the way, we should tell people it's on Sci-Fi, and it's on Wednesday nights at 10 and 10:30. There's two episodes. And by the way, I'm somewhat unclear on how many episodes there will be this first season.
There's the lucky number 13. There was 13 episodes made in season one.
Wow.
Cool. That's quite a commitment. That's not a minor endeavor from good old Sci-Fi, who can be abstemious, shall we say. And so, yeah, last week the first two episodes were the Titanic deck chair, which you did more or less authenticate, right? And you did purchase that.
Oh, yes, I sure did. As a matter of fact.
And the Houdini handcuffs, which is equally and perhaps even more near and dear to your heart. And then tomorrow we'll be seeing the Mohawk axe head.
That is a really cool story. The Mohawk axe head, initially we thought it was a war axe, possibly a tomahawk axe. And I'm not going to give it away, but through running around to archaeologists and people that studied it, we found out it could have possibly have been for a much more horrendous usage. And then it's got a quite nice surprise at the end, which in all my years of collecting, I've got to be honest, I've never gone and done what I did at the end of that episode. So it's pretty cool. People will be surprised. Hello?
It was really quite astonishing.
Are we still
Hello?
Connected? You're cutting out.
Uh-oh. Yes, we are connected. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Okay. So, yeah, I was just talking about how amazing the first two episodes were and that I finally, in my poor addled brain, made the connection that you are the really world-famous, most amazing escape artist in the world guy, as well as the Steve Santini who is the collector on the show when you perform that amazing feat at the end of the second episode with your poor daughter sitting there watching for the first time ever, I guess, seeing you do something like that.
Yeah, I don't normally bring Shayna out to my stunts and shows because, I mean, it's pretty intense. But she really wanted to come, and she got to sit right in the front row and watch Dad trying to pick locks on handcuffs as drills are inching towards his face down a conveyor belt. So that was a first for her.
Yeah, I mean, it's really an amazing kind of combination of entertainments and edification on this show. We get all kinds of historical background, and, you know, I totally get what you're saying. You wish you could show a little more of it because, you know, ultimately that's kind of the learning part of it, and that substantiates all this and kind of, you know, demonstrates how much time and effort and expertise goes into all this. But then you add into it the adventure where you're literally, you know, driving around and going from place to place and interacting with other experts and buyers and sellers. And then there's the whole escape aspect. It really is quite a remarkable show. All right, I have dominated, as is sometimes what I want. So, Teresa, turn it over to you for a few questions. Teresa? Ah, it's Teresa who we lost. That's what happened. now.
Yeah, I heard a dropout on the line.
Yeah, I did too. Let me bring her back on. Are you there, Teresa?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
I'm sorry. I don't know if it's my phone or the connection or what, but I was just getting bits and pieces of it, and then the call dropped. I apologize. Jumping in here.
Yes, please do. It's your turn.
I missed a little bit of the conversation, so I apologize if I'm repeating something. I was trying to catch up. The show is fascinating. Honestly, when I first heard the show, I was kind of like, oh, man, I don't know. Are they going to have, like, creepy things from Jeffrey Dahmer's kitchen or things like that, which I think is just really, to me, just kind of, I don't care for that kind of stuff personally. I know that there are people
right.
like that. But then when I actually watched the show and I saw it, I was thrilled with what we were doing. I think that focusing on the history that's attached to these objects is amazing. And I can just imagine some of the things that you've come up with.
It is amazing. I mean, the journey is amazing. And I'm not gonna you know, floss this over. Coming down the pipes on some upcoming episodes are some pretty horrendous devices and tools that were, you know, used in the past to, you know, coerce confessions out of people, persuade them. We're talking about execution devices, torture instruments. But it's interesting what you said about Jeffrey Dahmer, because during one episode, we were down in Missouri, and we went to visit this amazing shop, and I bought a number of pieces off the old gentleman that ran the shop. And when the camera was off, he said, oh, there's one more thing here that I have that's right up your alley. And he had some paintings done by John Wayne Gacy.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to be honest with you. I mean, look, there's a collector for everything, and some of the things I collect are pretty darn dark. But I actually had to say no. You know, it's just not me. I can't explain why. I mean, if you said, come on, justify that against, you know, some torture instrument that pulls your face off, I can't justify it. It's just my own comfort zone. Maybe it's too recent in our history.
Well, I think that's part of the thing with that, with things like John Wayne Gacy, and we've had just recently a serial killer here in the Cleveland area, and I think part of the problem I have with things that these serial killers or these people have, or this part of history, is that there are still people living that were personally touched by these things that would be
right.
kind of in poor taste and very upsetting. Now, some of these torture devices, like that one that you had on the girl's neck that was used to, what was it, to hold a witch down? Was that what it was? That big...
It was a garrote. It was actually for strangulation, slow strangulation.
Yeah, I mean, that's as gruesome as horrible as that is a part of history, and this is a part that gets glossed over sometimes, and I think it's important, and history's important. It's facts, and it's there, so I think that's important. But like you said, I'm very, very glad that you didn't buy those pictures from John Wayne Gacy, and I do understand that people are fascinated with it, but just imagine how you would feel if your a relative was a victim of this. I just think it's, you know, maybe it's too soon, maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm just too sensitive, but I'm all about, you know, gruesome is great, and as long as it's for his, hey, you know, it's
gruesome
history,
is great.
I like that. It is. I find it fascinating.
Alliteration.
I find it fascinating.
Well, I think that everybody has a dark side. I mean, Houdini had this great quote. He said, you know, human beings don't like to see other human beings lose their lives, but they like to be on the spot when it happens. So, like, we all, you know, we're driving down the highway. There's a horrendous accident off the shoulder on the right. We all look out the window, and we slow down to look out the window. And then when we see how horrible it is, we wish we hadn't, you know. But Deals from the Dark Side is kind of a glimpse into those horrific parts of our history without making them really gory. I mean, we stick to the true history of the artifacts without, you know, for instance, having pre-recorded screams and, you know, moans in the background. And that might be where the show touches on the paranormal. Like, I believe objects can be haunted, but strangely enough, the third floor of my entire place here is full of hundreds of objects that... If you walked in here, you'd say, this has to be the most haunted place on the planet. But not to me, because I treat these things with respect. You know, I present artifact displays for museums. And because of that, as long as I keep telling the true story of these objects, I believe that no harm will come to me whatsoever.
Now, that is fascinating. Go ahead, Teresa.
I was just going to ask real quick, do you ever get any sort of psychic impressions from these objects? Like, do you have the ability of psychometry? Can you pick something up and sense thing or get visions or anything like that? Is that something that you're capable of doing or anyone on your team is capable of doing?
Well, I'm very capable of that. I know that Steph is something of an empath as well, but I noticed I was capable of that. I had an escape go very, very badly for me when I was in my early 20s. I was locked in a tank of water behind a curtain. Nobody knew I was in trouble, and I ended up being underwater for over 5 minutes, and I died. And I kid you not, and thank God it was at a Shriners event, a Shriners dinner, and one of the head Shriners happened to be a police constable, police sergeant, and he jumped up on stage, pried the lid off, started, you know, CPR, and then an ambulance, and I spent a couple of days in intensive care with them poking and prodding and not letting me go to sleep for 24 hours, because that's what happens when you drown. And after that, I noticed, and I'm not kidding, it's the weirdest thing, where I can be, you know, touch an object and literally close my eyes, and I can picture it in use. And a lot of the time when I'm, you know, out there collecting, I travel a lot to Germany and Switzerland. We haven't seen that in the show yet, but when I get into a place that has a lot of history and I'm walking, say, a cobblestone street, I can literally feel people walking past me on either side when there's nothing there. It's more of an empath function.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Amazing. And you're saying that began when you had that accident, or was it intensified by that?
I think I was always a very empathic kid, but, I mean, after that accident, it became quite intense. Like, I can – and it's a lot different than what I think people would see on a ghost hunting show. It's almost impossible to describe. But, for instance, we were talking about those John Wayne Gacy paintings. When they were handed to me before, you know, he told me what they were, I just literally felt sick to my stomach. And I know Steph, who does a lot of the research on the show – she's also quite the empath, and although she doesn't go out in the field that much, I've seen that reaction with her too.
Interesting. Well, while we're on that line of thinking, why don't you just give us a little bit of your background? It's not the average person who just all of a sudden finds themselves with this collection of skills and interests. How did all this get started? And how do you, in your mind, how does it fit together? Because for me, although, you know, kind of on the surface they seem disparate, there's also some underlying things. And we should mention, on top of everything else we've already said, you also do mentalist and hypnotism shows, right?
Yeah, I did that for about 15 years, and I currently never have the time to do that again. But I was always fascinated with the mind and the power of suggestion. But anyway, the story, basically my story, I grew up in Toronto, and when I was a very, very young kid, I did a book report for school on Harry Houdini. I hadn't picked that. I was procrastinating, and the teacher said, look, I've got this book on my desk. Take it home, and this is going to be your topic. So I took it home, and I was reading about this guy, this Eric Weiss, that became Harry Houdini, this immigrant that was doing these incredible things with no formal training or whatever. And I honestly, I thought the book was a book of fiction. So it was a biography. There were no methods on how he did what he did. But I basically decided, all right, I'm going to find out if you can really do this stuff. So my poor, suffering parents, I mean, it didn't take them long. They were getting phone calls at home going, your kid is here. He's in our backyard pool. He's about to jump in. My son has locked his bicycle lock and chain around his wrists and neck. And you better get over here. He's never allowed to come over here again. And that's actually how the escapology stuff started. I was actually going out and doing this stuff.
How did you figure it out? I mean, in other words, it's not, or maybe it is. Is it an incremental thing? I mean, isn't it kind of all or nothing? I mean, either you know how to do it and you escape, or you don't. I guess I'm trying to figure out, is there a learning curve, and how does that
work? Oh, yeah, and it's a very painful one. Yeah.
I imagine so.
I mean, it started off with, you know, local neighborhood kids, look, tie me up, I'll get out of this. And, you know, I wasn't always successful, and then I got a little bolder, start jumping into pools. And then I remember I was 14 years old, and I walked up to 23rd Division of the Metropolitan Toronto Police after school, didn't tell my parents where I was going, and walked in there, this kid, and basically said, "Look, put your handcuffs on me, and let me go into a room by myself, and I think I can get out of them." And the cops thought this was hilarious. You know, this is a little kid coming in there. And so they cuffed me up, and I went into the other room, and about 20 minutes later came out with all the cuffs linked together in a chain, and they laughed their asses off, and they said, this kid's really funny. And then one of the cops basically said, "Well, we've got this holding cell. If we put you in this," and they put me in that and left the room and came back and checked on me. An hour later, I was still in the cell. An hour and a half later, I walked into their office where the detective offices were. And they were like, "Okay, this is really weird." So, I mean, my parents were not at all thrilled with any of this. I mean, they didn't want this.
With the direction your interest was taking.
Well, you know, in retrospect, as an adult, I think that they were probably thinking I was going to end up hurting myself or killing myself. So it was born out of a good intention. But because of all the strife at home over me, you know, it could have been worse. I could have wanted to be a, you know, teenage male stripper. But no, I wanted to be an escape artist. So it caused so much fights and stuff at home, so much strife in the home, that I ended up leaving at age 15, and I moved right to downtown Toronto. I found work at a locksmith shop, you know, for $10 a day, sleeping on the guy's basement floor and, you know, sweeping up. And that's where I really got to sink my teeth into the mechanisms and, you know, really get into it.
Did you leave school?
Yeah, I sure did.
Wow. So you're self-educated?
Which probably makes the journey that much wilder, because I did leave school, but I've been a voracious reader my entire life. If there's anything I'm ever interested in, I'll just devour it. But because Houdini was an interest of mine, I mean, even before Houdini, I was a museum buff. I mean, I was one of these kids that was locked into the past. I had to have it. And, you know, Houdini was just another element of, you know, a time that I'd never experienced personally, just like my interest in the Titanic. All these things that I have an interest in, strangely enough, are facets of history. And there's people that know me that say, "You likely lived several times."
Wow. You know, I have a personal connection to the Titanic. My grandfather had a ticket, was a scheduled passenger on the Titanic. And
cool.
He missed the boat. And it became kind of a family legend. In fact, I didn't think it was true for many, many years until I found the newspaper article that talked about it. It was said that that's why it was a family tradition that we were always late. The Gallaghers were always late, and that stemmed from my grandfather. But because of my grandfather being late and missing the boat is why we're here. So I thought that was just one of the tall tales that my family told, because they told a lot. They're from Ireland. Until I found a newspaper article in Mayo, and his nickname was the Iceberg and the Survivor. They called him a survivor of the Titanic, but he never did set foot on the boat. But I was also fascinated with the Titanic because of that. So, yeah, I think it's really neat. And every time I think about it, I think, wow, you know, if only, you know, that small twist of fate.
You're fortunate you might not be here had the
man
sailed.
exactly. Yeah, it's true.
But Eric pointed out something really interesting. Eric said, you know, that there's a connection, a thread running through all of my interests and the things that I've gotten into. And it's absolutely true. I mean, many of the collectibles are tragic, and some of them are quite simply horrific. But not to me. To me, they're fascinating. And this is going to sound totally off the wall, but I believe I have some sort of a deal in place with ancient ones. I don't know who the heck they are, but the deal is, as long as I continue to tell the story of these artifacts that most people would hide under, you know, a dresser, a drawer in a museum, they wouldn't even put some of these things on public display because they're so controversial. As long as I tell the true story, I believe I'll be allowed to continue to find rare objects.
Oh, my God.
I love that. And actually, I started talking about that, and then got caught in some circumlocution. Got my poor circular brain, but it did finally bring me back to it. And just what you said, it was in either the first or second episode, and you said the reason that you are drawn to these things and interested in them is because it is so important that we know that history and that we know what people have done to each other in the past and how they've done it. Because if you don't know the past, obviously you're doomed to repeat it.
It's amazing what people are capable of, you know. I think many people would shy away from it, not me. There's a common thing, I think, with people to, if the history is unpleasant, to just simply deny it ever existed. I don't believe in that.
You're right. I mean, when you go through your kind of your typical history book, even with the revisionism, and I'm sure the histories that are written and the books that are used are relatively similar in Canada and the U.S. And there certainly has been a period in the last few decades where we've had revisionism, and Columbus has gone from an unalloyed hero, you know, to someone who essentially single-handedly wiped out the native population. And of course, the truth is somewhere in between the two, of course. But we've had that history, and it is pretty sanitized. Sure, you're talking about for kids, but not even just for kids. The history, the tales that are told, really are they do kind of gloss over. You know, the U.S. history, you're going to tell about the good stuff. Sure, you'll toss in a few little picadillos here and there, Manifest Destiny and whatever. But, for the most part, it really is, what have we done that we can be proud of, and the founding fathers and so on and so forth. And I'm sure it's somewhat similar, at least, for Canada. So there do have to be people who say, look, here's the reality of it, and you may not want to look at it, but you need to consider it. Because, again, if you don't know the history, if you shy away from the history, then you're unaware of what human beings are capable of. And it's staggering what people are capable of. Until fairly recently, much of human history was about cruelty.
Well, we have a knack of being the most inventive species on the planet. We also have a knack of turning that invention in the most twisted, horrific ways. And in upcoming episodes, that's one thing I can assure the viewers of, or the listeners too, there's going to be objects that just stagger the mind. You're going to look at that and go, I can't believe somebody, sat down, studied the anatomy, human anatomy, and thought, okay, how can I make this hurt? How can I make this do this dastardly deed in the most horrific way possible? If we'd taken, I believe, like one-fifth of all the energy we've put into building atomic bombs and medieval torture racks and execution swords and all that horrific stuff and applied it to humanity and the progress of same, well, I think that by now we'd probably be colonizing other worlds and we'd be out in space and, we'd be far more enlightened, far more advanced, but we never have.
Interesting, though, if you there's any number of kind of philosophical approaches in terms of how you view history, and a lot of people view it as circular. A lot of people, do see it as, I believe the word's teleological, meaning it is going in a direction and there is such thing as progress. But I just read some really interesting, and it was backed up with very hard numbers, that right now is the most peaceful time in human history. And I find that really kind of amazing because, of course, on the news, mostly you hear about conflict and strife, and there's all kinds of problems here and there and everywhere. And yet, when you just look at the pure numbers, for example, even though the U.S. has been in, two quite major wars here for the last 10 years, the numbers, even if you just go back to the previous Gulf War from the 90s, of both deaths and injuries are way, way, way down. And while there's conflicts all over the world, relatively, and this is all relative, obviously, you know, you've had something like, what, 30,000 people killed in the drug wars of Mexico? That's a staggering number. But even with
it's
that,
incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It really is just astonishing. It's, you know, right across our border. So, you know, even with those kinds of numbers, though, relative to human history and taken as a percentage, you know, we're in the most peaceful time. So I would like to think that we are learning, and to a certain extent anyway, we are evolving. And I'm wondering, and this is just occurring to me now, I'm wondering if the reason for that it has anything to do with the fact that this is the era where there is the most information out there. This is the hardest time in history to hide something, as, for example, General Petraeus just found out.
Well, indeed, but I also feel that this is perhaps the era where there's the most possibility for dissemination of misinformation, because we're all so connected. We could say there's so much information, and that's something that, you know, when we're making deals from the dark side, when we're researching these objects, you can't just, like, even count on the internet for your correct answers or correct information, because if some historian wrote a book, say, on a torture instrument, and they wrote it 80 years ago, and they were one of the first to write it, and the information they got was wrong, every author that came after them and used their book as a reference material will repeat that wrong information. And you will end up with a pile of crap, basically, pardon my French, that just doesn't hold up. And then you have the job of battling against the misinformation to try and get the true facts across. Like, it was amazing, the Titanic deck chair, case in point. I mean, White Star Line carved onto the back headrests of all their deck chairs this five-pointed star, which was the symbol of the White Star Line, the shipping line that owned the Titanic. And, I mean, we took the chair to an Englishman who looked at the chair, and he was an antiques expert, and he knew something of previous Titanic chairs that had sold at auction. Right away, he said, no way. All the chairs have to have the star. And it was through Steph digging that she found a photograph taken on the decks of Titanic, anchored off Queenstown Island, that showed a chair without the star. So, I mean, if you go by, you know, all the authors that have written everything and just repeated what everybody else has written, you're not necessarily reading the truth. And yet there's people that claim to be academics that will say, I cite my sources as the following 30 books that I researched. Well, guess what? If the first book in that cycle of 30 books contained false information, everybody after that repeated the same falsehood, and you end up with a mess.
So you know how people feel when someone gets something wrong, say, in their bio on Wikipedia. Think of what a nightmare that is these days. Millions of people and people referencing Wikipedia as, you know, the ultimate resource.
You know what? I think that in all these things, like, I never cease to be surprised or amazed. In all the facts and all the things, I mean, you know, when we're researching torture instruments, I've got a huge collection of actual 16th and 15th century documents, the justice documents. You need to go back into the time and then place yourself in the medieval mindset or the Victorian mindset or whatever, and then strip away, you know, all the layers of hokum that have piled up over the centuries, and if you're lucky and you're tenacious, you will actually get to the truth.
What's something that you have found out through that kind of first source, direct historical sources, what's something that you have found out that really, really surprised you, or that just stands out in your mind, something that was perhaps contrary to what was generally held?
Well, certainly the Titanic deck chair. I mean, I know that's already been aired, but I mean, that was something that pretty much blew me away. I mean, I've worked with museums designing Titanic exhibits and so on, And, you know, I was of the mindset, yes, these chairs have to be marked this way. Yes, they have to have this emblem. And that's something that kind of throws the whole history of that out of whack, because now you have an American company filling orders the British ones couldn't do for the biggest ship in the world for her maiden voyage, using templates for the exact style of chair supplied by White Star Line, but they didn't have the punch to make the star, because that was owned by the British companies that made the same chairs. Things like that blow me away. And there's other things that really shock me that are coming up in upcoming episodes. So I really can't tip the scales on those right now, or tip my hat. But I'm constantly amazed. And one thing I found for sure, no one person is the ultimate expert on any one subject. You constantly, in the search for finding the truth behind these objects, it's really tough because people died centuries ago in some of these cases. And you can't visit an old guy in a rest home and he sits there and says, well, I remember when we used the guillotine to take it off. Those people just they don't exist anymore. So you're forced to do the research, and then the other part of the coin is use a good deal of common sense. And if you find something that has been written or something that is commonly believed, you have to look at it and take everything else into account to make a final decision. And in my case, when I'm buying these objects, I'm not buying them to resell. I'm buying them because I truly love these things. And also, I put on exhibits for museums around the world. I can't afford to make a mistake.
Right, obviously, that, you know, your judgment cannot be called into question, or kind of the whole house of cards collapses. Teresa, any thoughts, questions?
Yeah, a couple things. Staying on that topic real quick, and then I'm going to get off it for a second. Have you ever been duped? Have you ever bought something that you were pretty sure it was authentic, you thought it was authentic, you had it checked out, very excited, some object of any kind, and then later found documentation or evidence that it wasn't what you thought?
Oh, yeah. This happened. This has happened to me. I don't know a single hardcore collector that this doesn't happen to, hasn't happened to, or will not continue to happen to. They're mistakes, and they can be damn costly, but... Mm. I mean, it's just the way things happen. And nowadays, it's even tougher. You have, when you're dealing with extreme antiquities, you have countries, you know, like China, even India and Pakistan, you know, metal objects. They're aging them in India and Pakistan. They're making them, hand-forging them exactly the way they did back in the day. So you could be looking at a piece of metal, a piece of iron, that's got all the right patina. It's got all this. It's got all that. But in fact, unless you dig a little bit deeper, you don't realize you're looking like some of these replicas that are being made nowadays have fooled some of the finest auction houses on the planet. And people have always been doing it. They've been replicating works of art and replicating, oh, you name it. But, I mean, this is something also you have to be aware of. And like everyone else, I've made my mistakes. I'm only human.
Now, is there one object that you kind of have in mind, something that you've been looking for years that you've yet to acquire, and what is that?
No, I don't get to acquire it. Did you want that one, my wish list?
Yeah, one that you haven't gotten that you want to get, that you've been searching for. Anything in particular that you've been searching for and haven't been able to get it yet?
Yeah, and it's a piece that's iconic in the history of more modern justice, really, that I've been looking forever for an authentic electric chair.
Ooh.
Ooh. They think that one.
And there's people that would say, "Now wait a minute, that's too current, that's too modern." I believe when I put these exhibits together on cruel punishments or whatever, I want people to take into account how things are carried out under the law. I mean, all of these things, including horrific torture instruments, were all prescribed by law at one point in time, and you know. It doesn't matter whether a person is, say, pro-capital punishment or against it. The electric chair is an iconic piece. And it's something that everybody, every state pretty much, except for maybe one or two, have moved away from now. And, you know, who knows? Maybe in the future none of these devices will ever be used again. But it's something I've sought after for many years, and they are impossible to find.
Do people own them?
No. Well, there are a few collectors that have electric chairs that were used. Can you believe this? This is going to sound gruesome as heck. But in Mississippi in particular, they had traveling executioners. Can you believe this? That would go around with electric chairs on the back of flatbed trucks to towns that didn't have a prison with their own electrocution chamber. And some of those chairs have found their way into private hands over the years. But by and large, the ones used by the states for a state-sanctioned execution have remained in either police museums or prison museums, or they've been totally dismantled.
Wow.
Old Sparky.
Yeah, we have a replica of one in Mansfield Prison, the old Ohio State Reformatory. There is an old electric chair in their prison museum, which is on the site of the old reformatory. Now, they did not carry out executions at Mansfield, but they still have one that was from the Ohio State Penitentiary. It's pretty bizarre looking. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty gruesome, and it paints a picture just by looking at it, for sure. You know.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just commenting on it. Yeah, it's, you can just imagine sitting in it.
Well, you know, we've tried to, you know, that's another thing I find interesting about the hunt. It's not just finding the object, but it's finding out the truth about these things. And then it gives you a real hard and fast grip on where we are as a race, as a species, where we sit, you know, now comparatively, you know, to what we did centuries ago. We always try, you know, and paint ourselves as more humane. And in many cases, we're becoming more humane, and I hope that that trend continues. But, you know, there's always justification for bad deeds, and that creates the manufacture of bad objects to carry them out.
Right. Interesting. So when you're sitting at home amongst all these torture devices, implements of destruction, psychically charged items, what thoughts go through your head?
Honestly, I mean, my office is right in the third floor of the house here. I call it the Midnight Museum. And that's just a nickname I've given to the collection room, which also houses my office. Believe it or not, I'm perfectly at peace with these things because they all have display cases. They're all, you know, they're all looked after phenomenally well. You know, I'm not one of these people that, oh, there's a human skull, let's turn it into a bong or something like that. I care a great deal, and I think that I believe they're psychically charged. But the reason I believe that there's never been a problem is because of the reverence and respect I have for them. For instance, a couple months ago, for the first time ever, we let a paranormal team into the house here to come and look at this collection. I'd never done it before. I'd had people asking forever. Finally, you know, these were people that I knew and I trusted, and I said, come on in here. And they got the wildest, craziest readings. Their equipment went completely bonkers, and there were EVPs, and it was quite phenomenal to sit back and watch the equipment just screaming, you know, the millimeters and stuff just going off the scale. And they all looked at me like I was nuts. How do you live with all this stuff? And I said, guess what? Nothing ever happens to me. Ever.
That is really, that's amazing. It really is. So when you're saying nothing happens, I know earlier you had said nothing bad and you have no fear of these things. But are you saying that there's never any sort of paranormal activity of any kind associated with these things?
No, I'm not. No, if I said that, I'd be lying. I mean, I'm not going to. There's no ectoplasm oozing out of the walls, and blood dripping from picture frames and stuff. But what has happened is there's been noises. There's been drafts and the cold spots and so forth. My daughter, who's 14, she won't even come up here after dark. And I tell her, look, I'm up here working. Come on up, visit. Let's talk. She will not come up here. She feels these things up here a lot more menacing than I do. To me, I've given them a good home. I'm at peace with them. We respect each other. But Shayna will not come up here.
Interesting. I really like your approach and how you've worked that out mentally, and I like, I think it's terrific that it works. You know, that, I mean, you have a system, you're confident about that system. Now, I suppose we should ask, which I guess we haven't yet, when you do obtain something new, is there any kind of ritual, or I don't want to overstate it, but is there anything that you do before you install it? I mean, do you do anything formal or even semi-formal when you bring in something, or is this just kind of a tacit understanding that you and the objects have with each other?
Well, as I said, I believe we have a deal. It sounds very bizarre, but the deal is, you know, you find us, we'll allow you to continue to have a meal. Like, anyone that knows me as a collector knows that I find the rarest objects on the planet, the hardest to find things, and, you know, they're amazed at the luck. I don't think it's all luck. Certainly luck plays a part in it. But we have this deal, you know, look after us, continue to tell our true stories, and perhaps we'll allow you to find more things, and you won't be, you know, you won't be bothered by these things. But there have been objects that I've encountered, you know, over the years that I might want someone to do a smudging on. I mean, I know Biker Rob has done that for me a couple times. When I've had pieces that just, they just don't feel right. They're not exhibiting any weird paranormal activity, but there's something so ominous and so heavy about them that, you know, we'll do a sage smudge, and maybe say a prayer, maybe, and that's the extent of it. But really, I think that's only been done, you know, just a handful of times.
Do you believe in ghosts? I mean, I know that. Oh, this is all kind of paranormal and psychic impressions, energy. But do you believe in ghosts, in spirits, and, you know, what we would consider a typical ghost, like a person who has died, whose personality is still here in the physical world in some form? Is that something that you believe in?
Well, you know, as a historian and as being the type of guy I am, I mean, I put my faith first in science, second in recorded history, but I'm going to be quite honest with you. Of course I believe in ghosts. I've had experiences of my own in the past, seen things. I've been with people that have seen things. Yeah, no, I have no doubt whatsoever that whatever this body is, it's a vessel for all our life experiences, our energy, whatever. And when it dies, it's got to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. I do believe, yes.
I just
Very
was wondering because I was fascinated with Houdini, but for different reasons, because during the age of spiritualism, where he didn't believe and he was, you know, debunking these seances and exposing these fraudulent psychics and things like that. But I personally do believe in it, and I do believe that you can connect and contact with people that have crossed. And I just was curious as how you felt about it. I kind of thought you'd say you did believe, but you never know, because some people believe in certain aspects of the paranormal, but they don't believe in
right.
everything, and you just didn't know where you stood on that. I think that if a normal person might be around all the objects that you've collected, they might, even if they're not psychic, might still get a certain vibe or an energy or a heavy feeling, whatever it may be, and to me that is something that's paranormal, but I think that almost everyone would probably have a reaction. It's
right.
kind of like, I don't know, maybe it's like, you know, people who, like, I don't get scared when I go on an investigation. I'm not afraid of ghosts. Maybe it's because I'm around them all the time and I accept them, and they're not that unusual to me, and they're not that unknown to me. I think maybe it's the fear of the unknown gives you that, ooh, what is that, that kind of thing.
Well, I agree with you, and I think the power of suggestion, and I you mentioned earlier I did stage hypnosis for a number of years. I have seen the power of suggestion do the most miraculous things, both on stage and off. And I believe that, you know, if you walked into this place, if the average person walked into the third floor here and saw what was here, immediately they would be quite disturbed and distressed by it. And this has happened with people we've had here at the house that have, you know, wanted to see the collection. They'll come up and, you know, the look at it, the initial, you know, in one cabinet, there's the head of a decapitated young lady that was killed for witchcraft in the 1600s. There's the bones of a person that was broken with a medieval wheel dropped on them, and all these things. And the person, people will come up here, look around the room and go, I got to go. I can't stay here. But then something really interesting happens. This is just on site alone. Then I start describing to them the traditions, the justice, the history, the this, the that, and they end up staying hours. And by the end, when they walk out the door, and I think that that's something that deals from the dark side, is really going to communicate to people. These things, on the surface and face value, you'd look at them and you'd say, man, you are messed up to collect that stuff, dude. You are disturbed. But once you start looking into the history, then you suddenly realize, you know what, this is parts of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
But until you do that, the power of suggestion is in full play. And people just come up here and go, I got to go.
That brings up something. We only have about 10 minutes. The time flies when you're talking to an amazing, fascinating guy. I was wondering, and I realize, well, I'll just leave it at that. Would it be possible for you to literally kind of walk us through? I'm just fascinated by this, and the issue for me is I can't imagine how these things happen. Could you walk us through one of your escapes and give us at least a sense of what you're actually doing to extricate yourself from these situations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one that just aired was an escape called The Ripper. And we have, my friends and I have a joke that I was Saw before the Saw movies were Saw, because what I did is take the old vaudeville Houdini behind a curtain thing, take away the curtain, get rid of the frilly costumes, and do it like Alice Cooper was a huge influence, you know, in my life, and I love his music and Alice's showmanship. And, you know, if you see one of my stage shows, it's metal and there's, you know, it's heavy duty. And I find that heightens the senses. So, for instance, The Ripper, the one where, you know, I'm chained up, I'm in a kneeling position, my hands are handcuffed with cuffs that are inspected by the audience, my thumbs are locked into thumb cuffs. Those are chained to the underside of this big, long metal conveyor belt, but it's not really that long. It's about 5 feet long. At the far end of this conveyor belt is a chain drive unit that starts sending down three power drills that are running slowly, slowly inching towards my imprisoned head as I kneel at the opposite end of the conveyor.
I had to turn away for a moment when I was watching that.
Yeah, no, it's a real thing, and here's the way I do my escapes. This isn't a trick pair of handcuffs, you push a button, they're opened. This isn't, you know, put me in a box, put a screen in front of it. The audience, and this is the way I like to do these things, they have a visceral experience because they can see the drills getting closer. They see what I have to do. By force, I have to pull my thumbs out of these spiked thumb cuffs, then use the thumb cuffs to try and pick open the handcuffs. Use one restraint to defeat another, and then, if there's enough time, reach behind me, undo the next strap, and dive backwards before these drills give me a very expensive dental and eyeglass bill.
So there's no trick. I mean,
and you think of these things? These come from your mind. You're like, oh, I think I'll have drills coming out my head, and while I'm chained up, these are things that you think of, or are these other like something that Houdini or someone else did?
No, these are things like I never wanted to be an escape artist, like, you know, at this point in my career. And that, like, if you go to my webpage, you can see I'm breaking out of castle dungeons and prison cells, and I'm doing this stuff in full view of the media. There is no trick. It's using physics and science and pain control. This was the only way I felt that you could get a modern audience who's seen everything and are quite jaded to actually, you know, feel the visceral experience and be there with you.
I'm sure.
Amazing.
I'm sure it is.
Oh, I was just seeing it on TV. It was plenty visceral. I can imagine being there in person. And again, talking about your daughter seeing you go through this for the first time, that must have been quite an experience for her. Before we run out of time, we need to make sure everyone knows about where they can get a hold of you. And as we were saying earlier, your site, SantiniCentral.com, is outstanding. All your background and overall bio, your extreme escape work, the artifacts work, your museum work. And we haven't even talked about the fact that you're an author. I mean, you're not just a historian in terms of knowing what you know so that you can go out and obtain and authenticate your various items. You're a multiply published author in these fields. I mean, you literally are an expert, you know, in these various historical fields. And your inventions and the mentalist hypnotist work, it's amazing. So it's Santini, S-A-N-T-I-N-I, central.com. Excellent website. And we absolutely refer people. They got to watch the show, which is absolutely rocking. After only two episodes, you know what the first thing I said when it came on and you started talking? Oh, my God, he is so eloquent. I am really happy, because you're kind of scary looking, you know, but you are a very erudite and eloquent fellow. You're very, very well spoken and intelligent. I thought, I have to watch this anyway. Thank God he is smart and well spoken.
Well, thank you. You know, that's probably one of the nicest compliments, because, yeah, I do wear leathers and I got tattoos and a mohawk, and I mean, people look at me and they go, oh, don't piss this guy off, please, don't make him mad, you know. And it was so funny when we were making deals, you know, when we do episodes of deals, we ended up meeting with forensic pathologists and scientists and you name it, and they all had the same reaction. It's so funny.
Right, I'm sure they did.
Walk into the room, the cameras are set up, and they just look at me like, oh, my God. And then I'd start talking to them in their lingo, because it's also my lingo. And by the end of the episode, when the cameras were shut off, I can't tell you how many times it happened. These guys would be walking up to me saying, what a pleasant surprise.
Well, I mean, you are a performer. So, I mean, you're not just personality. You have a persona. So I'm sure that's part of it. But the other thing that I failed to mention, yet another element, is, man, you are a sharp negotiator as well. And I'm sure looking somewhat intimidating doesn't hurt in that regard.
Well, I mean, it's tough when you're negotiating with some people, because you always have to straddle the line. I mean, I want to be honest with people. I don't want to look at a piece that I know in my heart and in my soul is worth $5,000. And then I say to the guy, oh, you've got the Holy Grail here. I'll give you $50. You know, I always try and be honest with people as far as I can. But, of course, I'm going to negotiate very hard if there's a piece of the puzzle missing. Like, you get a lot of these objects passed down with an oral history because, as I said, nobody, you know, still extant was around centuries ago. And so my team and I, we have to fill in the pieces to try and prove what this person is claiming this device to be. And even at the end, sometimes we have to take a leap of faith. I know in my heart what it is. I believe that the story holds up, but there's always going to be one or two elements that are slightly out of sync. And, you know, occasionally, I will admit it, I've used those as a bargaining chip, because when you're talking about, you know, one or two degrees of doubt, that could cost you tens of thousands of dollars. Sometimes you've got to get hard on it.
What
sure.
is your most prized possession of all the things you have in your museum, or even on loan to another museum? What is your prized possession, if you can narrow it down to one or two?
I have a wonderful thing here. I have a pocket watch that was taken from a body that was recovered after the sinking of the Titanic. And this pocket watch, the crystal broke and the dial and the hands are completely rusted. You can't even see what time it is. But to me, the watch is incredibly powerful, because that person, literally, when they jumped from the deck of that liner into the ice-cold water and broke that crystal and the seawater got into the watch, at the time the watch stopped, they stopped. It's
wow.
incredibly poignant to hold that in the palm of your hands and realize that, you know, somebody was thinking, oh, what a grand ship, this is wonderful. And then they might have looked at that very watch going, time's running out. Will I find a place in the lifeboat? Oh, my gosh, it's been, you know, half an hour. The ship's tipping more. It's profound.
You really are ultimately an empathetic guy. I think that's really the bottom line. And, you know, that really counts for a lot. I think that explains why you have the reaction that you do, because you do so place yourself in other people's shoes, and you really have that ability, and you don't shy away from it. A lot of people have the ability, but they don't want the pain, you know? It's like, God, I got enough pain of my own. I'm not going to take on other people's pain, too. So that's
special. But I think, well, thank you, but I, you know, and I will admit, it gives me nightmares at times. I mean, it deprives me of sleep, but I think the honest, true end game here is, once again, telling those people's stories. And that's what I aim to do. And hopefully we can get a modicum of that across to the viewers that watch Deals, and I do that in my real life. And so if I can tell the story of someone that was long silenced, no matter how they went, I think that that person has a measure of peace that they never had while they were living.
Well, that's amazing, and that is an exceptionally apt way to close the show. Thanks so much, Steve. What a pleasure talking with you. I'm really excited to see the rest of the series, and I hope it's a tremendous success. Both Teresa and I thought the first two episodes were just fantastic. So let's once again let people know, Sci-Fi Channel, Wednesday night at 10 and 10:30. There's two half-hour episodes back-to-back, and there will be 13 episodes in all in this first season, and I am certain that it will be a great success. And what a pleasure to speak with you, and we wish you only the best in all of your various endeavors.
I want to thank you both, and I want to thank all my American friends and fans that, and new fans that are getting to like the show for tuning in, watching it, and supporting it. It's been a great adventure. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's been great talking to you, and hopefully we'll have you on again sometime.
That would be great. Thank you.
All right. Good night. Farewell.
Good night.
Thank you, everyone.